This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, for the first time, President Obama's poll numbers are down significantly in Black America. Other polls show two-thirds of whites agree with the Zimmerman verdict, and the Bush-Obama surveillance regime comes under strong challenge in the U.S. Congress.
But first, outrage at George Zimmerman's acquittal and the death of Trayvon Martin sparked hundreds of demonstrations and vigils all across Black America. Kevin Alexander Gray is a political activist and author in Columbia, South Carolina. We asked Gray if it is possible that a Black mass movement may be gelling.
Well, you know, jelly is a mix that you got to put together. I think we do have to figure out who in that mix of people that's marching, some for the very, very first time, who have now had a taste or had their political consciousness tweaked. You have to figure out what it is that they can actually do to feel as though they're having an impact on the process and on their lives. So from the perspective of, you know, movements don't just spontaneously happen. And when things happen, it's not like the people just massively go to the street and stay in the streets. You have to do things to keep them moving. You have to have victories. You have to have benchmarks. You have to have a place to go. You have to politically re-educate a lot of people. You have to build a movement, and you have to manage a movement, and you have to organize things. So there's hope that that might happen, and there's hope that it might happen around some key issues. If folk are upset because of the death of Trayvon Martin, because they're opposed to racial profiling, because they're opposed to the idea that because there's this law called Stand Your Ground that gives people license to come up to them and ask them what's their purpose on the street, and it could possibly escalate in somebody losing their life. If it's about systemic profiling and the war on drugs and how it feeds into the new Jim Crow system, then there are things that people can do to attack those legislative and structural roadblocks that people of color face. But it does take freedom schools, it takes organizing and educating the people to go out there and do that. And so I'll give this moment in time the benefit of the doubt that we can do that. You know, I'm an organizer. We've done that in the past. We did that with the Voting Rights Act. We did that beyond the Voting Rights Act with having plaintiffs to file lawsuits under the Voting Rights Act. We taught them about single-member districts. We taught them about at large. We taught them the basics of organizing, and we taught them how to register people to vote. There was a period when we were expanding voter registration, and now we see things are going the opposite direction because we haven't been organizing and we haven't been keeping up and teaching people and keeping people motivated and in the process in the same way as, let's say, the gun lobby and the gun rights lobby in going from the Castle Doctrine to the duty to retreat, to now stand your ground, and concealed carry laws, and open carry laws, and cities being sued by plaintiffs so that individuals can have guns. The pro-gun people have had a plan and operated on it. So, you know, we've got to match that. We have to have a legislative plan, not just on the national level, but at the local level where it counts. And if we're talking about racial profiling, we've got to talk about the war on drugs and decriminalization and legalization. And in all that, we've got to talk about the surveillance state where the government at the local level and the national level can profile you by surveilling you every day of your life, that they're able to stop you if you're brown and ask you for your immigration papers or your legal papers or your birth certificate or whatever, and they're able to stop black folk and search them for contraband or whatever. And so we've got to talk about how this whole idea of keeping white skin privilege in place We've got to talk about the idea that the only people that are being required to show something to prove that they're a citizen or to prove that they're not guilty of something are people of color in this country, and we've got to figure out a way to fight back or organize coalitions amongst blacks and browns. But we're at the point now that we're at the beginning of the beginning, where we ought to be talking about freedom schools, where we ought to be getting people into those freedom schools and out in the community and talking about racial profiling, talking about the surveillance state, talking about the police state, and making all that stuff applicable to their lives, letting them understand the linkages between what we've been talking about for years and how it's affecting their lives right now.
And yet it is precisely those structural problems, the problems of mass black incarceration and hyper-surveillance that the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, has such a poor record of tackling.
Well, there's a breakdown in the black community as far as leadership is concerned and the goals of leadership and who leadership serves that's just overwhelming, which is why we're losing on so many issues. So, I mean, we could talk about the Congressional Black Caucus. We can talk about the blackness leadership class all the way up and down the line. But the other part of it is, you know, we've relied on the NAACP, which has gotten old. And for the most part, you know, NAACP is just like the Rainbow Coalition, is just like NAN, it's just like the Urban League. Their funders are corporate funders, and they're going to parachute in and jump in front of something, and they're going to get a check. Meanwhile, at the grassroots level, nothing gets done. Everybody goes to the big march and listens to the same old speeches, and nothing gets done. And then even the leadership structure, where the ministers all meet because we've got this so-called ministerial leadership at the top end of it, and a lot of these ministers on the local level, they know as much about politics if they haven't just sold out to prosperity gospel and getting the gold from people who are struggling. They're not out there leading any social movements, but by the very construct of what they're standing up in front of every Sunday, their script is already set. So just because they're religious leaders or ministers, you're going to deem them leaders and then put them in front of people, that ain't about nothing either. We need to start talking about democratic structures and new organizations, freedom schools, looking at legislation, locally and nationally, figuring out how to run people against people, looking at plaintiffs to challenge the onslaught that's going to come at us when these legislatures come back into session to unravel some of the voting rights challenges that we've made in the last 5 to 10 years that have protected us. Those are things that we've got to do right now. And for those politicians that are leading this right-wing white supremacist charge and roll back, we've got to figure out how to attack them at the point of where they live, picketing their houses, identifying the people who are funding the kind of politics that they're practicing and not spending money with them, putting real pressure on people to make them change their politics. And that's going to come out of those young people and some of those people that started marching.
Yes, lots of people have been impressed by the demographics of the demonstrations, that so many young folks are involved.
That's the good part about what it is that's come out of this tragedy with Trayvon Martin. Young people felt that that trial was about their value as black kids, their value as kids, and they now understand. I mean, they use the word nigger in their little rap songs, but now they know what it feels like to be a nigger. They all had white friends, and, you know, it's trendy and hip to use it, and they don't understand the historical context of no rights any white man is bound to respect. They're just learning about Emmett Till. They're just learning about Dred Scott. They're just learning about Mandingo and the myth of Mandingo. And this is where we're at right now. So you have to give them something to do that they can feel as though they're making a difference. Even like the Dream Defenders, they're not afraid. And they're sitting down there in the governor's office in Florida. Now, I don't know how much they understand about the context of where Stand Your Ground comes from and the idea of Southern Constables or even the history of Florida and the Seminole Indians. I don't know if they understand that. But somebody ought to be helping them to put what they're doing in context and help them build out from there. And help them figure out how do you really put pressure on that legislature and how do you really call people out. We're talking about a movement, and movements are about cooperation and building networks and building personal relationships with people, and really talking about government and really understanding how highly politicized the era that we're living in is and what that means for structural change and the possibility for structural change. The Supreme Court basically nullified the Voting Rights Act. Daniel Brown basically nullifies the social contract between blacks and whites that have existed since after Jim Crow. You go your way and I'll go my way, to where it gives extrajudicial rights to what is going to be a predominantly white gun-carrying class. Profiling and racial profiling in the war on drugs means that the idea of chattel, which goes back to slavery, using people as chattel or a commodity within an economic structure that feeds on having a black underclass and going after surplus labor. And oftentimes that surplus labor is used for private companies within a for-profit prison system. All this stuff becomes right to talk about in this new environment. And how do we challenge it? 2 years ago, 3 years ago, folk weren't listening to this. We've been knowing this has been going on for years, and we've been critiquing it and talking about it. Now people are starting to connect the dots. But the folk who are out there making the critique about exploitative capitalism, that are making the critique about the police state, that are making the critique about America, the money that goes into the defense, the money on the local level that goes into law enforcement, the surveillance state on the national or international level, the surveillance state on the local level, people are starting to make those connections, and we just got to help them keep on making.
So you think there's a new level of receptivity to these actually old ideas of fundamental social change?
Absolutely. And you know what? And when the president comes out on a Friday and suggests that he understands a little bit about profiling, although I think that some woman clutching her purse in a mall or somebody locking their doors, that might or might not be profiling. It might be the smart thing to do. If you've got a pocketbook and you out late at night, that's something that a woman might do for any stranger, regardless of what race they are, any strange male. Racial profiling, as we know it, is about feeding the criminal injustice system. That's what it's about. It's about the police and the surveillance state. It's about stopping people and dehumanizing them in ways large and small on a daily basis under the color of law. And every Terror Tuesday, Obama and the people who decide that somebody got to be killed in the mountains of Afghanistan or Pakistan or Yemen or wherever else they fire off a drone, peace profiling people. Profiling isn't a new thing, and it isn't just restricted to black people. All those hundreds of thousands of so-called undocumented immigrants that are locked in ICE facilities all around the country, how do you think they got there? They were profiled. So we've got to expand the movement and keep making the connections and attack the structure of empire and this excess money in the police surveillance state. Because from what I've read in my history books from throughout time, there have not been many police states that have held up over time. And they all disintegrated into the kind of violence that these politicians claim that they're trying to fight off.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray, author of The Fundamentals of Black Politics.
The Trayvon Martin saga may have been the catalyst for serious cracks in previously solid black support for Barack Obama. We spoke with Dr. Johnny Williams, a professor of sociology at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
It's a perceptual change, actually, of President Obama in the sense that NBC and Wall Street Journal just released a poll saying that his support among blacks is starting to decline precipitously. Since April of this year, it was at 93%, and then in June it went down to 88%, and now it stands at 78% black support for Obama. And that is a big-time shift in how it is that they're perceiving, that is how we're perceiving as black people, Obama when it comes to being responsive to the needs of our community and of black people around the world, too. So it speaks a lot about how it is that we are being the covers. The wool is basically being drawn from our eyes, and we're starting to look and see the President of the United States and his policies for what they actually do, instead of trying to get into what he's saying, even though that's still there, especially among many of my colleagues in sociology, especially black sociologists, people saying that he has, when he spoke about the fact that 35 years ago it could have been him who was Trayvon Martin. Some of my colleagues said that it showed tremendous courage of the president and that he provided much-needed context and so forth for the nation when it comes to understanding how systemic racism works in this country and so forth. But for me, as a critical sociologist, my take has always been with Obama, I can't believe what you say because I see what you do. And that's what I get from him with an old James Baldwin quote. Again, I can't believe what you say because I see what you do.
Well, President Obama claims that he's against racial profiling, that he's sensitive to the pervasive suspicions among white people that black people are up to no good, and remembers being the target of those kinds of suspicions. But we also know that he's considering naming Ray Kelly, the police commissioner of New York City, as the new Homeland Security chief. And Ray Kelly has overseen the mother of all stop and frisk operations that has stopped and frisked more than 5 million, mostly black and Latino men, since 2004.
Yeah, and the thing is that what is known as, instead of stop and frisk, racial profiling that is commonly known, the conventional words in the media and so forth among people, the popular way of saying it, is it's known as race-based policing. And I remember the first time I had an encounter with a police officer at the American Bar Association. I think this guy was from Seattle. I think he was the first black police chief up in Seattle. But he was talking about this race-based policing and how it basically generated animosity and rage in communities that it is used upon. And so for Obama to consider bringing in somebody like Ray Kelly, who he basically gave him praise for his qualifications to be the next chief of Homeland Security, is very problematic. Because it speaks to where, in a great sense, where Obama is morally. Again, he says one thing, but he does another. How are you going to put somebody who was basically doing the same thing that George Zimmerman did to Trayvon Martin, how are you going to put that person in Homeland Security who will then take race-based policing to the next level? Ray Kelly's stuff was being used actually to harass Muslims in New York City. There's multiple reports about infiltration of Muslims by the NYPD and so forth, and try to get informants and so forth. So for Obama to do what he's doing, to say one thing and do the next, I mean, speaks of the height of hypocrisy on his part, but also it's questionable morally. How could you say publicly one thing and basically do the other?
Ray Kelly has said in very explicit terms that his brand of stop and frisk is designed to instill fear in young black and Latino men, fear that they'll be accosted and patted down and confronted by police whenever they step outside of their homes. Is this the kind of environment that we want to see for the whole country emanating from the vast Homeland Security apparatus?
The question is this. Why are they doing this in the first place? Why did they respond to, say, the Boston bombing suspect and the overwhelming force that they did? I mean, it seems like everything's just like a rehearsal. They're practicing for something. In my humble opinion, I think it's the fact that the country is basically on the verge of being a police state, if we're not a police state yet. For black people, I think we've been in a police state since we've been here. But the fact is that these people who basically own the country and running the country through their corporations and trying to run the world, they see people as the enemy. And to do this to black people, they're practicing on black people also in anticipation of doing it to people who call themselves white. So it's a bigger question about Ray Kelly that one can take out of the black community, because we're experiencing this oppression firsthand. We've been experiencing it since we've been here. But it's getting worse. And it's being led by a black man who seems to not care about just ordinary American, let alone black Americans. He don't care anything about people. He cares only about his funders, that is, the people who made it possible for him to occupy the White House in the first place. All one has to do is look at Open Secret's website about who funded his campaigns and continue to provide support to both the Democrats and Republican parties. We see it's not the people, so they're not going to be responsive to us. So then he will put somebody like Ray Kelly in the position to basically keep people in place. That's what they're telling us as black people, is that we got to remain in our position. That is opposition or subjugation to the system that is hostile to our being in this country, basically on this planet. They want to use us. That's it, and throw us away like we're nothing. And the president and his whole administration basically seem to be buying into that through his various policies. But look, I'm in the state of Connecticut, and this dude comes to my state after the Newtown shootings when it was a very wealthy community and sheds tears about that, but not about Chicago. He had to be basically coerced into going to Chicago by some colleagues of mine at the University of Chicago to get him to come out there. And then he got out there and he tried to talk down to black people. But he didn't do that in Newtown when he came, right? It's tremendous empathy. But there seems to be no empathy for black people who are his staunchest supporters. Even down at 78%, he still is not being responsive to us. And so it's basically you got to hold your breath if you expect anything from the Obama administration when it comes to black people in the United States.
Professor Johnny Williams of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
An ABC News Washington Post poll shows that two-thirds of whites think Trayvon Martin's death at the hands of George Zimmerman was justifiable, while 87% of black Americans strongly disagree. Yet, President Obama insists that race relations are improving in America. Author and activist Paul Street has been following Barack Obama's career from the early days in Chicago. Street says Obama has always been wrong about race.
There's so many polls out there now, so many surveys, not just on this and other matters, that just completely blow away Barack Obama's claim in the speech that made him a phenomenon and an international superstar in 2004 when he said that there's no black America, there's no white America, there's no Latino America, there's just a United States of America. Well, you look at this type of polling data. You know, the Zimmerman case is very polarized, but there's similar types of polarizations on other questions. You couldn't get further apart. We really are living in separate worlds with regard to how we think about the current events. And, of course, that separateness in perspectives reflects very real, savage, and profound literal physical segregation. I don't know what Caucasian America possibly could be thinking about that, but, you know, two-thirds of the white population saying that it was justified, that's a lot more than just the segment of the white population that's Republican and the segment of the white population that's Tea Party. There's a lot of Democrats in there. And that probably includes a whole bunch of liberals. I heard even Jimmy Carter recently sided with the Zimmerman verdict recently, even though he's been saying some fairly decent things about Obama and Snowden and the NSA and all that kind of stuff. So this isn't just about cracker whites in the Jim Crow South or in the Republican electoral districts in the Midwest. This is a lot of folks in liberal America. If you're going to get that kind of a two-thirds number, and I'll just tell you, I live in a predominantly white. Absolutely, to this day, Obama mad college town called Iowa City, where, as I wrote about in Black Agenda Report in 2009, in June of 2009, they just gunned down a young black man, a Sudanese man named John P. Ordain. I got about Johnson County Sheriff named Terry Stotler did. And all these people who in liberal campus town America were so proud of themselves about their supposedly anti-racist statement of voting for Obama couldn't lift a finger about this just blatant shooting of this young man right in downtown Iowa City. My summary here is that we are in very separate worlds and Obama was completely wrong and overboard.
Yes, Obama is very careful to say at every opportunity that although things may seem bad, race relations are getting better in the United States. But the proliferation of stand your ground laws in recent years, which many people believe, and he seems to even suspect, was a leading cause of the death of Trayvon Martin, or at least the mentality behind stand your ground laws, oh, that's a recent phenomenon. So how are things getting better?
That 15 minutes, that's all it was, about 2,000 words of supposedly impromptu commentary before Jay Carney's press briefing, was the most instantly heralded Obama intervention on race. He almost never says anything about race, except when he has to, except when he feels compelled to for reasons of political survival. So the Philadelphia race speech after all the Reverend Wright stuff, you know, he had no choice. He had to talk about it. What he said was very milquetoast then, back in 08, March of 08, very centrist. You know, it wasn't all that much. It was, of course, instantly heralded by people like David Brooks. And that was true again in this case. And he ended at the end of this very weak, sort of sheepish, almost apologetic, mealy-mouthed kind of discussion of which he's claiming to feel poor black people's pain because of the violence they feel on communities, trying to personally identify himself with it. And he says we should never forget that things are getting better when it comes to race. In his talk, at least, as far as I could tell by his observation, that his daughters are having nice interactions with their very rich friends at the elite private school they attend in Washington, D.C. And I'm at a loss for exactly what he's talking about. I mean, the epic incarceration of blacks and the epic marking of blacks, which is so endemic that one in three adult black males has, you know, crippling lifelong mark of a felony. You know, it continued to rise through his administration. Blacks have had the biggest foreign income since 2007, a bigger foreign income than any other racial group by far. Their net worth has fallen to $1 on every $20 of white median net worth, and black net worth has fallen to its lowest level in decades. 30% of black kids are officially poor compared to like 12% of white kids. I mean, you can just go on with the unemployment disparity. I mean, I just don't know what he means, but there you go. He's trying to please whites and make them feel unthreatened, which has been his M.O. Forever and will apparently continue all the way in through his lame duck period as president. He can't be elected anything else anymore, but I suppose he has an agenda that he still thinks he would like us to believe, that he's a progressive agenda that he's trying to advance. And he doesn't say anything that triggers whites any more than they already are by the fact that a technically black guy sits in the White House.
Clearly, if we go by the numbers, black progress has been ambiguous at best. But maybe Obama's talking about white attitudes towards blacks and vice versa. But even on that score, if two-thirds of white people believe that Trayvon Martin's death was justifiable, how can we even say that there's been progress in that arena?
You know, I actually think in many ways we're seeing backwards drift
in white racial attitudes, just getting worse. But I'm not sure that finding would have been as bad a few years ago as it is now.
This Towson Harvard's poll, that now for the first time since they've been asking people about this, majority of whites now say that they are the leading victims of racism in America, not black Americans. Whites are saying this. A majority of whites. Again, a majority of whites, that's more than just the Tea Party people. And, you know, that I know the Tea Party people because I research them. And obviously, very predominantly white, and their whole thing is that they're victims. A majority of whites now say this. What the hell is going on? How could they possibly think that? There's nothing in the socioeconomic outcomes in this country right now, which are getting worse for blacks. What are they talking about? You know, I think it has to do with the concentration of wealth and income on the predominantly white ruling class and the barriers to mobility and the shutdown for a lot of white middle and working class people. You know, the avenues are being closed. And they don't see a lot of blacks because we're still so segregated, except on TV. And they see the sort of steady kind of litany or parade of supposedly successful, well-off African-Americans, a black president, which just really gets under their skin and feeds the sense of paranoia. And they're really victims of class inequality. They really are. There's incredible savage class inequality. It's within the white community as well as within the whole society. But we've demonized class analysis. We don't teach it in the schools. We don't give jobs. I know this personally from my own experience. We don't give jobs to college professors who think in terms of class analysis. We marginalize people who think in terms of class in the white community, in the whole national community. You've got to blame somebody. You can't think in terms of class. And you watch TV, and some people listen to Fox News, the Tea Party cohort does, and hear about how all these supposed blacks and Latinos are taking over the whole country. And so now whites, amazingly, astonishingly, believe that they are now the primary victims of discrimination, I guess, in the workplace and the community. I have no idea what really they're talking about, but I think I have a sense of why they think this.
During the first presidential campaign, Barack Obama said that blacks had come 90% of the way towards racial equality.
He was saying this at the very moment that the Great Recession was destroying household net worth in this country. And blacks, because they have so few, relatively few financial resources, disproportionately have their wealth tied up in homes. And so when the home market imploded savagely, as predicted, it particularly hurt Black America and just sent their net worth tumbling. So how he possibly could have said 90% of the way to equality when it's one black cent on 20 white cents in net worth is just kind of mind-boggling. I mean, why he even went to percentages and numbers where he couldn't possibly make his point, I'll never know, except to please whites.
President Obama says he didn't think that a conversation about race that involved politicians would be particularly helpful. What do you think?
I was more struck by the fact that he didn't seem to mind pulling a whole bunch of politicians and businessmen together to discuss for 2 or 3 days, was it, his corporatist health care bill. He doesn't mind pulling politicians together for pulling together scheme to attack Social Security and Medicare. He doesn't seem to mind pulling politicians together to make policy for international trade agreements that assault labor and working communities and the environment. But now he's skeptical about pulling politicians together? I wouldn't mind us pulling some politicians together on the condition that they had to answer to an organized mass of people who actually demanding something of them so that they can put some meat on the bones of their discussion and call for things like real jobs programs and real ex-offender reentry programs and real drug treatment programs and real infrastructure developing programs. So pulling politicians together in a context where their feet are being held to the fire by an organized constituency would be pretty good with me. He seems to like to pull politicians together just without that constituency around.
Maybe what President Obama really means is he doesn't think that a conversation about race, period, is helpful to him.
No, he knows it isn't, right? It's not helpful to his agenda, whatever that agenda might be. And, you know, he said in this alleged great transcendent moment of racial liberalism, in that 15-minute impromptu speech, he said flat out
that I don't think we're talking about any big federal program. You know, a federal program wouldn't do anything.
Well, we need a great big federal program to solve a whole lot of problems in the black community, in the Latino community, in the white community as well. And he's a vacuous to repressive neoliberal who talks about small-scale solutions, you know, conversations down at the kitchen level, you know, on the community level. You know, whenever it comes to anything that makes him uncomfortable but doesn't mind great big federal programs like the military-industrial complex, this corporatist all power to the big six insurance companies' health care plan he's got as a federal program, he doesn't seem to mind. So it's all hypocrisy. This man is skirting with becoming something of a joke. At this point in the second term, I mean, it's just getting laughable. Even liberals I know who've paid a lot of attention to him over the years are starting to tune him out. This vacuous nothingness just really starting to wear thin. And so many liberals have disgraced themselves in their enthusiasm for this really shockingly mediocre and deeply conservative president.
Paul Street is author of The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power. The U.S. House narrowly defeated a bill that would have prohibited the National Security Agency from collecting and storing Americans' phone records. Shahid Batar is executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. He says the close vote was a tactical loss for civil rights. He says the close vote was a tactical loss for civil liberty forces, but
it's clearly a strategic victory because to come so close, 217 to 205, to a vote that essentially would have defunded one of the most secret parts of the federal government and one of the most disturbing facets of the war on the Constitution and the American people, that's a remarkable victory. And it really reflects how much the wind has shifted since Edward Snowden disclosed details about some of the NSA's illegal and constitutional activities to the public.
Polls have shown that the American people in the majority are quite upset.
As well they should be. You know, we fought the Cold War years ago very much on the premise that we were the good guys in the context of a battle with a system that was founded on dragnet surveillance, among other civil liberties abuses. But we in the United States now practice to an even far greater degree many of the same civil liberties abuses that our nation's enemies once did. You know, the Soviet Union, East Germany, they never monitored their citizens to the same extent that the United States government does today. And that should disturb anyone who was around then, because those were values to which our nation was existentially committed. And even though we won the Cold War 20 years ago, we have essentially lost it since then to our own government.
Yes, we hear people who we would not usually identify as leftists using terms like national surveillance state.
Absolutely. It's interesting. In some respects here, the most outspoken champions of constitutional rights in the face of the NSA abuses have not been progressives. You know, libertarians have been much more willing to embrace those issues. And to some extent, that makes sense, because if anything, they have a partisan antipathy toward the president, whereas progressives, at least many progressives, have ambivalent views toward the president or nuanced views on different issues. But the fact of the matter is that the Obama administration, and these are the words of a Bush administration press secretary, on national security issues, the Obama administration is the fourth term of the Bush administration, because it has extended and continued and escalated many of the same attacks on constitutional rights that began under the Bush administration. And it does make sense that Americans from all walks of life, all parts of our country, and all political persuasions are joining together to raise their voices in unison.
And how did this grouping of what some people would consider strange ideological bedfellows manifest itself in the vote in Congress?
You saw a very broad bipartisan vote on both sides of the amendment, both for and against. We basically saw establishment Dems joining establishment Republicans to support the NSA and the national security state and the military intelligence industrial complex. And then you saw populist, often Tea Party-influenced Republicans joining with progressive Democrats to challenge illegal, secret, unconstitutional domestic spying. And the fact that the vote split each of the major corporate parties suggests to me that on these issues, this is not a partisan fight. It's not left versus right. It's we the people versus the corporations, and in particular, we the people versus the NSA. And it's interesting that we the people share a voice across political parties. It reflects just how deeply these issues resonate with the American psyche. You know, we sing anthems at baseball games about living in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, these kinds of issues is where the rubber hits the road. And if we are the home of the brave, we will choose to repudiate these kinds of lawless abuses of our rights. And unless we repudiate those lawless abuses of our rights and restore our fundamental rights as Americans, we cannot claim plausibly to be the land of the free.
On paper, the Congressional Progressive Caucus is about the biggest caucus on the Hill. But in terms of their voting behavior, have they lived up to the progressive part of their name?
Many progressive Dems did. It was surprising to see others cave in the face of pressure from the NSA and the president. It's worth noting that at the 11th hour, after this amendment was scheduled for a vote on the House floor, the NSA conducted a full-scale blitz on Washington, trying to scare members of Congress into thinking that if they defunded this program, they'd be somehow making the country vulnerable to a terrorist attack. And that's just, it's cheap points. It doesn't hold any water. It reflects the institution's impetus toward self-protection. But what's interesting here is that so many Democrats and so many Republicans saw through that farce, recognized the self-serving behavior of the NSA, and an interesting point here, also perhaps acted on their own institutional interests beyond their ideological interests in restoring constitutional rights. I think many members of Congress recognized an institutional interest as members of Congress who had been kept in the dark and lied to by the executive branch across each of the last two presidential administrations from both of the major corporate parties.
Well, that's the legislative front. What's happening on the judicial front? You've joined with a host of other organizations to sue the NSA over its spying program.
We did just last week. I'm very excited that the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, the group I run, is represented by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They are some of the nation's strongest civil liberties lawyers, and the case is very exciting. It particularly raises First Amendment associational claims alongside the Fourth Amendment search and seizure claims that have been raised in prior suits. And one of the things that's most exciting about this case is that the Snowden disclosures, in prompting the Director of National Intelligence to finally admit to Congress that the NSA is in fact collecting private information about millions of Americans every day, and the disclosure of the Section 215 order in particular to the UK Guardian, that admission and that document give us the right to challenge the law in court. And in prior cases, courts have refused to reach the merits of cases and instead said that nobody has the right even to challenge the law because of the secrecy of its application. So it's very exciting that we're around the standing barrier and that the case is raising these very important First Amendment associational issues that really have not been front and center in the public debate about the NSA's unconstitutional programs.
Many of us who are not lawyers fail to understand how there can be a law that is itself secret and its justifications for being are secret.
If it makes you feel any better, those of us who are lawyers are only more incensed by it because it really doesn't make any sense. I mean, that is the essence of arbitrariness. It is the essence of authoritarianism, and it is antithetical to the democratic ideals on which our nation was founded. And members of Congress from both sides of the aisle, Representative Conyers, who is the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee and one of the deans of the Congressional Black Caucus that you mentioned before, he and Representative Justin Amash, second-term Tea Party-influenced Republican from Michigan, they have banded together, in addition to the vote on the Defense Appropriations Bill, also on affirmative legislation to curtail NSA abuses, and they had a joint statement about precisely the issue you raised in terms of secret law. And it is particularly revealing, I think, that members of Congress, as well as lawyers and non-lawyers from across the political spectrum, recognize how just completely illegitimate that is. In their joint statement, they suggested that, and this is a quote, "Free countries must not operate under secret laws. Secret court opinions obscure the law. They prevent public debate on critical policy issues, and they stop Congress from fulfilling its duty to enact sound laws and fix broken ones." That's the end of the quote. And it's interesting where they talk about the impediment to Congress's duty that secrecy represents. That goes back to the institutional interest that members of Congress share, regardless of what they might feel from a partisan or ideological standpoint about these issues.
Yes, it seems that this debate is expanding beyond concerns about U.S. foreign policy and is now focusing on the nature of the rule of law.
That's absolutely right, because if we think broadly about the issues on the table, it's not just the case that the NSA asserts the right to tap the back end of the internet and the phone system and is doing that and has been doing it for the past decade. The executive branch has also signed a law passed by Congress at the end of 2011, the Defense Authorization Act, that could enable detention without trial or proof of crime in military custody, even for Americans, which is to say jailing people indefinitely on the basis of suspicion without proof or judicial process. That is preposterous. I mean, it's basically like flipping habeas corpus, and that stood for 800 years. And even though habeas corpus rights still apply, in the wake of the NDAA, they apply very differently. And so we're talking not just about pervasive surveillance, but also arbitrary detention. And don't forget, when torture was being committed by the Bush administration, and I should note, remains ongoing by the Obama administration, particularly in the context of force-feeding inmates at Guantanamo Bay. When torture has been committed, no one has ever been held accountable for it in the U.S. The only person serving a prison sentence for torture is the CIA employee who tried to stop it and a Justice Department employee who tried to stop it. That's John Kiriakou, who's in prison now, and Jesselyn Raddick, who is not, but was prosecuted for her efforts to restore the rule of law in the context of torture. So we have pervasive surveillance, arbitrary and indefinite detention, and torture with impunity, which is to say the government can jail any of us for no reason at all, perhaps, for instance, based on what we might say, while government officials who commit grave abuses of our species' most fundamental commitments not only escape any accountability and get off scot-free, but in many cases retain their government positions and taxpayer-funded paychecks. There's a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, Jay Bybee, who signed several of the torture memos. He has $250,000 paycheck every year for life and the power to decide the law as it pertains to the rest of us, even though he can't travel abroad for fear of being detained as a war criminal.
Regarding military detention of U.S. citizens without trial or even charge, the president says, well, he wouldn't do that to an American citizen. Take his word for it.
And I appreciate that, and it is better at least to have a president who's willing to pay lip service to due process issues than one who is not. But we have to be real here. President Obama will not be the president forever, and whoever comes into office next will inherit those powers without necessarily sharing the same appreciation for their limits. And whatever you think about the possibilities of abuse under this administration, the fact is laws transcend administration, and laws can be abused by anyone. It doesn't even take the president. Any prosecutor in the chain of the command, or any contractor at the NSA, or NSA employees themselves, you know, they can spy on their ex-wives. They can use these systems to find the scuttlebutt on their neighbors. These programs are dangerous precisely because they are secret and unaccountable. And when programs are secret and unaccountable, they lend themselves to abuse. That is a central principle that I think many Americans, such as the members of Congress who voted against the Amash Amendment, they have forgotten that abuses are inevitable when controls are taken off. But unfortunately, in the context of many of these powers, like detention without trial, or for that matter, pervasive surveillance, Congress, rather than checking and balancing the executive, has actively empowered and aggrandized it when Congress passed the 2012 NDAA with provisions for domestic detention without trial and military custody. It didn't check the executive branch. It gave the executive branch powers that at the time the president actively tried to resist. He threatened to veto the NDAA at one point over the detention provisions. When Congress had a chance, first in 2008 and most recently this spring, when evaluating amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that's the statute under which the NSA is collecting many of its bulk electronic intercepts, when Congress had a chance to stop those abuses, instead of changing the law or considering amendments to it, it approved a blanket five-year extension, even though they didn't know what they were approving, right? The NSA's programs have been secret, not just from the public, but also from members of Congress, even members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who have clearance to review classified documents. They have a particular responsibility to oversee these kinds of activities, and many of them have actively sought more information about these activities by the executive branch, only to be told that the answers are unavailable or would somehow violate Americans' privacy, even when, of course, it's the NSA violating people's privacy, not the effort to comply with congressional questions that they're obligated to answer. And I should note one other thing here, just on the issue of congressional oversight and transparency. Edward Snowden, the whistleblower, has been the object of a great deal of attention. And in the focus on his whereabouts and his asylum struggle, the extradition drama, forgotten, I think, to many people, have been the crimes of the executive agencies that he revealed. And when the Director of National Intelligence appeared before Congress in March, he was asked point blank by members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, is the NSA collecting the private information of millions of Americans? And he lied to Congress. That's no small matter. He didn't just lie to the people in the room. He lied to the press. He lied to 300 million Americans. He has absolutely no right to do it, and it is a clear crime, perjury, for which anyone else would be prosecuted. And the fact that no one is prosecuting the executive officials who have committed clear crimes on the public record, whether it was signing torture memos or whether it was lying to Congress about what they're doing in our names with our tax dollars, the impunity with which executive officials have been allowed to denigrate and violate the law en masse makes as much a mockery of the rule of law as the denial of fundamental rights to we the people of the United States. And just to bring this point home in one way more sharply, it's especially poignant to have this conversation in the wake of the Zimmerman verdict and the mobilizations around the country responding to the death of Trayvon Martin and the unaccountability with which our criminal and justice system responded to those events. There are 2.5 million Americans in prison today. A quarter of our planet's prisoners in the country that claims to lead the free world, while torturers sit on our federal bench and executive officials lie to Congress with impunity. And the contrast between relentless, vicious, predatory prosecution of generally powerless people on the one hand, and the insulation and impunity with which politically powerful people stand above the law is especially galling, and I think it informs all of these different policy questions. And up to this point, it hasn't informed them enough. But I see in the vote, the narrow loss on the Amash Amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill, a rising transpartisan tide that does seek to do just what you said, restore the rule of law in the United States. And it's shameful that it doesn't currently operate. But we do not live in a free country right now, and we do not live in a country governed by the rule of law.
People who usually don't bandy the word about are using it, some of them, these days. That word is fascism and the structures of fascism that appear to be being constructed.
It's interesting you should raise that. Conference at which you and I both spoke in New York several weeks ago, I facilitate a panel on exactly that question. Is fascism rising within the United States? And I'll cite someone else just to put this not in my mouth, NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake, who was prosecuted under the Espionage Act for doing exactly what Snowden did, disclosing documents, revealing fraud and abuse, not operational details of any program, not sources or not details of any investigation, not compromising national security, but revealing fraud and abuse that the American public has a right to know about. When he was prosecuted for 4 years, a federal judge ultimately had some very strong words, not for him, but for the prosecutors who wasted public time and money in pursuing this public servant. Thomas says that when he was at the NSA, particularly in the 80s, his job entailed monitoring and surveilling East Germany. And he has a fair amount of expertise in the East German political system. And he says that since being prosecuted and then ultimately vindicated, he has traveled internationally. And when he goes to Germany, what he hears from Germans is that at least we know, we Germans, we know we live in a post-fascist state. You Americans live in a pre-fascist state, and you don't even know it. It's not just the case that we've lost the Cold War to ourselves. If World War II was the last great war, many people say, and it was against not just a particular regime, but a set of principles, and those principles are rearing their ugly head here within the United States. They include the collusion between the corporate private sector and the public government sector to abuse fundamental rights. That's exactly what the NSA program and the Section 702 prison program is in particular, because there you have telecommunications and internet companies being paid secret amounts of taxpayer funds to enable and facilitate abuses of our rights en masse. I could not fathom a more corrupt enterprise. Fascism also entails xenophobia and militarism and the sort of connection between vilifying the other within our country, justifying international belligerence towards other countries. And we see that up and down the line in the United States. Think about the way that we Muslims are discussed, or the way that Latinos are viciously attacked in some circles. You can see this all throughout the enforcement provisions of the Comprehensive Immigration Bill making its way through the Senate. And the national military belligerence, I would imagine by now, is fairly obvious, but we have a habit of invading other countries at the drop of a hat, and these things all go together. Militarism abroad, xenophobia domestically, denigration of fundamental rights, and the collusion of the corporate and government sectors are all defining elements of fascism. And people in the United States, I've met many who will roll their eyes at the suggestion, saying, oh, there's not gas chambers, that's ridiculous, this isn't fascism. And I would just say, you know, fascism looks and smells different ways in different systems. It's not always goose-stepping and mass deaths. It can look softer than that. And that's what we live in. And in fascist systems, it has always been easy to get along if you go along. And to people who go along here in the United States, it can be very invisible. But remember, that's what makes it so dangerous. Read the history from the Third Reich. Everyone in Germany in the 1930s, who was around at the time, says that they didn't realize what was happening. That's exactly what's going down in the U.S. today. Nobody realizes how bad it's getting because our corporate media doesn't connect the dots. That's another element of fascism, is the use of propaganda to basically brainwash people and distract them from real news and to focus them on fake news. And that also happens in the United States constantly, right? I mean, the trivia that dominates corporate news coverage relative to the very vital fundamental issues that are largely ignored in our popular discourse, even if it's not outright government propaganda. Again, we have this collusion between the private sector and the government, not just to facilitate, for instance, pervasive surveillance, but also to distract, confuse, and I dare say keep in the dark the American public.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Heather Content.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.